Hello, everyone. Happy New Year. Is Kevin McCarthy just too nice to be Speaker of the House? Why can't Republicans get their act together and stop behaving like a dysfunctional family at the holidays? And the 11th chapter of the Twitter files just dropped. Plus, we endured the worst year in the stock market since the great meltdown of 2008. But wealth wizard Ed Butowski says the worst is over and stocks will rise 10% or better this year.
But I think I got this one nailed. I really do. I think March 6th is going to be the low point, and we're going to see things start to change then. And you asked why. And again, it's because of clarity.
And in my parting shot, the upside of optimism. How to make yourself feel better by finding the silver lining everywhere you look. Welcome, guys, and thanks for joining me for episode 5 of my new podcast. What's bugging me today is the self-inflicted embarrassment of the Republican Party and Kevin McCarthy's bid to become House Speaker. For the first time in 100 years, the majority party has failed to elect its leader on the first ballot. McCarthy failed 3 times in a row before the House had to give up. And counting. Now, this is a bad look. The media are filled with stories about Republicans in disarray. The House is now, quote, in chaos, the BBC reported. The New York Times said, quoting here, the failure to pick a speaker underlined the fractious nature of the GOP conference on its first day in control. And for once, the New York Times has it right. I mean, the failure to elect Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House does indeed underscore the fractious nature of the Republican Party. And here's what the media won't tell you about this unnecessary mini-crisis. This orneriness in the Republican Party is a weakness, but it also is a strength. There's 20 arch-conservative mavericks. They oppose Kevin McCarthy because he is part of the Washington establishment. He's too willing to give in on conservative principles and join with Democrats in lavish spending and irresponsible borrowing. The fault here lies with Kevin McCarthy rather than with the 20 ornery Republicans who dared vote against him. I mean, here's a guy who clearly underestimated the opposition, right? And then he failed to offer the right concessions to win it over. I mean, Kevin McCarthy is like a character in Death of a Salesman. He's liked, but not well-liked. And even more to his disadvantage, Kevin McCarthy isn't feared. Both qualities are mission critical for any Speaker of the House. They have to be well-liked backslappers, yet they also must be willing to smack their foes in the face. And Kevin McCarthy may fail on both counts. The media also won't tell you that this too shall pass. We will have a Republican House Speaker sooner or later. If it isn't Kevin McCarthy, Jim Jordan would be a sterling improvement. Either way, life will go on, and so will Congress. Even ornery Republicans want to stay in business so they can reward their friends and punish their enemies. But then there are so many things the media want to avoid telling you lately, so they're not going to tell you that. I mean, I put in more than 30 years with the mainstream media, the Wall Street Journal, Forbes Magazine, CNBC, Fox Business. And today, I don't recognize the media at all. They are biased and high-handed and unabashedly ultra-liberal. They publish slanted stories and errors and lies that favor their own narrative. And I've actually proven this with the columns that I write. And more than ever before, the media ignore stories that contradict their beliefs, their ideology. Now, that's why I created this show, What's Bugging Me, to call them out and to call out charlatans of business and government and politics and elsewhere, and to tell you the stories the media would prefer to bury. The Twitter files is the latest, most outrageous example. The 11th release of these internal emails and Slack conversations and documents at Twitter, it came just a day or two ago, and we now know that the FBI became the so-called belly button into Twitter for dozens of other government agencies and officials, all of them making illegal, inappropriate, and unconstitutional demands that Twitter censor the views posted by thousands of Americans, censor them, rather than letting them come out and punish anybody after the fact because they said something illegal or in some way or libelous. We know the State Department's new intelligence arm, the GEC, or Global Engagement Center, it pressured Twitter into submission by going directly to the media to criticize Twitter for allowing too much Russian influence on the platform. And by the way, for all the fears of Russian disinformation in the 2020 election, where the hell was it? Where was this influence? It's just a ridiculous boogeyman. We now know that the FBI alone had 80 agents on a SWAT team devoted full-time to censoring the views of Americans. The CIA was in there, and the State Department, and the Department of Defense, and a Foreign Surveillance Committee, and dozens of state police departments, and state elections officials. All of these government agencies used Twitter as their own listening post to monitor the statements of thousands of people. They silenced conservative accounts. They played up messages that supported the government views. They muzzled even small accounts with little activity. All of this is proven and documented and shown in the Twitter files. These agencies, these people, they had Twitter delete tweets that quoted accurate, publicly available data from the CDC. They had Twitter silence even small accounts with very few followers and very little engagement. They had Twitter wipe out even election jokes because they might be, quote, election disinformation. Disinformation, the new boogeyman requiring government censorship. It's all a terribly slippery slope, and we've seen it slip right before our eyes. I mean, you've also got other bad forces in there. The shiftless Adam Schiff, who demanded the shutdown of an account that revealed the whistleblower in the first Trump impeachment. And, requests from the Democrat National Committee and the Biden administration. Oh, and the Trump administration, too. We know this only because of the great American billionaire Elon Musk and a handful of independent journalists who no longer write for the mainstream media. Matt Taibbi, Barry Weiss, among them. Meanwhile, though, the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, the rest of the media, they've looked the other way on this story. For more than a month now, shameless shills. And this whole thing is so distressing, so disturbing. It embarrasses me and outrages me as a journalist. I cannot believe my colleagues are ignoring such a violation of the First Amendment that is central to their existence. It alarms me as an American. I mean, the First Amendment right to free expression, the freedom from government interference in that, it's named first in the Bill of Rights for a reason. It is the foundational freedom for all other rights we have. And the government has been using Twitter and the rest of social media to violate that right and impose an illegal prior restraint on content that is neither dangerous nor harmful. If there even is such a thing as harmful content, I have my doubts about that. People are harmful. Content can't pull the trigger on an AR-15. I've been hammering on this story, the Twitter files, in every episode of What's Bugging Me, and I urge you to go back and listen to it because you won't find this stuff almost anywhere else. Also, I've written 5 stories on the Twitter files in my Mediaverse column at TruthDAO. That's Truth D-A-O, TruthDAO.news. I've got a 6th column most recently on Newsmax.com, What's Bugging Me There, and 6 columns by Dennis Neal. Now, that is more coverage than the entire staff of the New York Times has given to the Twitter files in a full month. And shame on them and every other media outlet that is burying this story. What happened to you guys? Even my beloved Wall Street Journal, where I spent 16 years as a reporter and editor, is all but ignoring the Twitter files. The Journal just ran a roundup of the year's most important stories, and it mentions Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter and leaves out the Twitter files entirely. Now, to learn the real story, please check out the 5 columns I've written at truthdow.news, my most recent What's Bugging Me column at Newsmax. Please forward the links to your friends. Americans have to know what their government is doing while the media look the other way. This isn't a Republican or Democrat issue, guys. This is an issue of the freedom of our people and the oversteps of our government. both Republicans and Democrats in power are happy to use Twitter and Facebook and the rest of social media as their tool to retain power and quell dissent and silence the opposition. The media are letting them get away with it. The media are allowing this to happen, which is why I want your help in getting this news out to the rest of the American people. They have to know what's going on. Now, in the Wall Street Journal, my friend, the columnist Kimberly Strassel, she reports that Republicans are ready to rev up a new investigations committee to probe this vast overreach by the government and our intelligence agencies. That's great to hear if and when it happens. For now, though, the Republicans have been strangely silent, lacking much outrage about this spreading scandal. It makes me wonder what they have to hide themselves in the Twitter files. Got to take a quick break here. Please give your highest rating to What's Bugging Me wherever you listen to your podcasts and subscribe to the Ricochet channel on YouTube where you can see my video interviews. We got a great one up next. Ed Butowski has managed hundreds of millions of dollars of other people's money, and he joins us to give his surprisingly upbeat and bullish outlook for investing in the new year. Cue guitars.
Hey, James Lavick here, reminding you that just because the elections are over doesn't mean there's not stuff to talk about. There's lots. There's looking back at what happened. There's looking back at the stuff blowing up today and taking a look at the stuff that might be blowing up tomorrow. We'll talk about it all in the next Ricochet Flagship Podcast.
All right. And now Ed Butowski, Wealth Wizard, joins us to give us his outlook for the markets and the economy in 2023. We appreciate your being here, Ed. Ed and I worked on the book that he put out called Wealth Mismanagement, in which this 20-year veteran of Wall Street big firms, Ed says that Wall Street's kind of bad at managing risk. See the FTX collapse in crypto that he talked with us about in a recent episode. So, Ed, it was one of the most horrible years for stocks, certainly the worst since 2008. The S&P 500 down, what, 20%? The NASDAQ down 33%. Is the pain over?
Well, I'll tell you, the pain, I believe, is over. But I think that it's going to be a slow process to recover. And the reason I say that is that Wall Street looks for clarity. And they look for clarity on earnings and interest rates. That's the key to how stocks are priced. And I believe that as we get into the first quarter, somewhere around the second half of the first quarter, I actually put out March the 6th, just as a date, where I think things are going to start to turn around. So watch and see if that happens.
And why'd you pick March 6th?
Because stocks move 6 to 9 months ahead of earnings and economic data. And I believe we're going to have clarity on where earnings are going to be, because interest rates are going to be, we're going to be able to identify where interest rates are going to go. And that'll be priced into the overall stock market. So I believe we're going to see the Fed fund rate go up to about 5%. And stay there.
Only another half a point raise, really, in that case, before they then stop.
Yeah, I believe so. I think we're going to start to see inflation number comes down quite a bit. And that's going to give companies the ability to have clarity on and prediction on where they're going to spend their money and how much things are going to cost. And once Wall Street gets clarity on things, then they can start pricing it accordingly. So that's what I believe. I believe 2023 is going to be a much better year than 2022.
Sure, that's for sure. Now, we lost $12 trillion in collective stock value. And $3 trillion of that was just from those big five big tech stocks, the FANG, right? We've got Facebook, Meta down 64% in 2022, Netflix down 50%. The other three, Apple, Amazon, Google down 27% or more. And so it seems like we're being offered a chance to buy some of the glamour stocks at a real discount here, unless those companies are over. So what do you think about the FANG, just as a little sidelight there, on those stocks having lost this much value? Does your optimism extend to them?
It does. I actually believe the large cap, which are big company growth companies, those are companies that don't pay really nice dividends, but are really big and they're growth oriented. So for those of you who are listening, you have to remember that a value stock, if you took the sum of the parts and broke it up, the company is worth more than the sum of the parts. And that's why you have a value stock. Growth stocks are betting on future growth and earnings. So, and I believe Amazon and Apple and Google and Facebook, Netflix and so on, and Microsoft are going to do very well. You know, I threw Microsoft in there as a thing, but, you know, so it kind of plays in that bucket as well.
You know, but, Ed, this is the most bullish and optimistic that I've heard you in a long time. And, you know, in the past year, the Russell 3000 value index, and value is, you know, slower growing companies and not the hot tech glamour stuff, that did 20 percentage points better than the Russell 3000 growth index for 2022. And so you're kind of looking for more of a reversal at a time when, I mean, Goldman Sachs is thinking that the S&P 500, that index of the 500 largest companies, that it rises maybe 4% total in 2023 is their forecast. What would your number be by comparison with 4%?
I'm, you know, I'm just throwing it out there. I think we're going to see about a 10% rise in the S&P this year. And that's going to come as a result of clarity on earnings. Again, you know, Goldman Sachs is a huge firm, really, really smart people. And I'm sure they have a lot of statistics to back up with what they're saying. Mine's real simple. I think we're going to have clarity on where interest rates are. We're going to have clarity on earnings growth. And even though the stock market's still expensive now, I think it's going to start to grow into this.
Now, of course, everything relies on the Fed. The whole reason the market started falling apart, I think it was in November of 2021 is when the highs were reached for many of these biggest stocks. And everything started falling apart as the Fed raised rates, the equivalent of, what was it, 13-fold from, you know, a quarter point all the way up to 4.5%. An amazingly jarring impact on business. You know, we had 30,000 layoffs at big tech, but we had over 100,000 layoffs, it turns out, at startups, where VC suddenly put on the brakes and instead of telling them to grow at any cost, suddenly changed the entire thing. This is going to have kind of long-term dampening effects on economic growth if we aren't careful and go too far. Now, the Fed, though, they can't afford to raise rates for much longer, can they?
Well, they can afford to. I mean, they can do it. And their goal is to get inflation down to 2%, which is going to be a Herculean effort. But I believe we're going to start to see that trend. And remember, on Wall Street, the genius of investing is recognizing the direction of trends. Right. So if you see a trend where you start to see clarity on earnings and interest rates starting to drop, believe it or not, I think towards the end of 2023, we're going to see a drop in interest rates on the short end.
Well, yeah, they're going to come back down. They're overdoing it already. And by the way, talk about the outlook for recession. We just saw a story break where 23 economists, the economists at 23 different banks that do business with the Fed are bracing for a recession this year. And of course, it's self-defined. I mean, the Fed's going to make it happen at all costs. And yet we're surviving so far. Christmas sales were up 7%, Visa said. Consumers haven't gotten the message, gotten the memo.
I'll tell you, there's this old thing about Wall Street that, you know, they did a survey of about 100 different economists on where interest rates would be 6 months later. They do this two times a year, and they almost always miss by about 80%, miss the direction of interest rates, let alone where interest rates are going to be. So again, these people are very, very smart, but I think I got this one nailed. I really do. I think March 6th is going to be the low point, and we're going to see things start to change then. And you asked why, and again, it's because of clarity, because people are going to start to get an idea of what the first quarter numbers are going to look like, and that's going to lead into the second and then third quarter. And we're going to have a really good year, I believe.
Yeah, if anything, expectations have been dampened down, tamped down sufficiently by the Fed to where there is a room for a surprise upside here. Now, in terms of sectors, energy had great time in 2022. Does energy continue to do well in 2023, do you think?
Yeah, and that's the one thing, you know, that people might take fault on me for saying, because I do believe energy prices are going to go higher. There's such a demand for energy that the supply is not out there. And as long as they're playing games with how much oil is being produced, we're gonna probably see higher prices on gas and oil. But a lot of that is already baked into the market. So again, you have to remember what's already baked into the market and what are they forecasting, because the market is a great discounter of future events. And they've already discounted higher energy prices.
And it's discounted the recession, it seems like, which they're already braced for that. And,
yeah, but I don't think we're going to have a recession. I think, really? Yeah, I think we're going to be able to, you know, if you look at how they play with those numbers, and the recession is two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth.
Right.
We'd have to have the fourth quarter negative and the first quarter negative. And I don't believe the fourth quarter is going to be a negative GDP. Right. That doesn't mean we're going to have a robust economy. But I just don't believe we're going to have a technical recession.
Well, everyone believes that the Fed watches GDP growth, and the GDP growth is a measurement of recession. In fact, the Fed is far more concerned about employment and unemployment. And when you look, I think the latest numbers are something like 11 million job openings, 250,000 new jobs in November, unemployment rate below 4%. You just don't see recession in those job numbers.
Right. Yeah. And I'm kind of a right-leaning person, but I will tell you that, you know, a typical right-leaning person would just throw everything out there and say everything's terrible. But I'm very realistic as to what I believe. And I truly believe that we're going to see a pretty good market towards the second half of 2023.
Okay. And now let's turn quickly to bonds, because you're not a fan of bonds overall. And that U.S. bond index fell 13%. In 2022. And that's compared with the steepest drop for that bond index. When you go take prices back to the 70s, I read somewhere was left like 3% in 1994. It fell 13%. Mm-hmm. You pointed out last time you were on with us, you said that this is also the first time ever that it had fallen more than 10% along with stock prices. Instead of usually, guys, bond prices should go up when stock prices fall. That's why we have bonds in our portfolio. So what do you think is the outlook for bonds in 2023?
Well, I'll tell you, if you took for 2022, if you looked at the 60-40 split, the 60% equities, 40% bonds, that index was down 17%. That's the worst it's ever been down, that 60-40.
Together, yeah.
But I will tell you that I do believe that we're going to see a compression from the high yield side, where we're going to start to see those rates come lower, and we're going to, you know, kind of see this reverse inverted curve start to change. So I think you're going to start to see the lower end of the market go down towards the end of 2024. And the 10-year is probably going to stay right about where it's at, but it's not going to be an inverted yield curve.
By that, the inverted yield curve, you mean lately, because the Fed's been raising interest rates, the interest rates on short-term bonds or treasuries, like the two-year, have been actually higher on an annual basis than the rates paid on 30-year bonds or 10-year bonds, right?
Yeah, they went from about 25 basis points what they were paying, or on the very short end, you know, to about 4%. So you said a 13 times, you know, move. It was a dramatic shift in terms of what people were getting paid for those bonds. But you have to remember that if you owned a bond that was paying you 1%, and then that same bond went up to be paying 3% on new issues, that 1% bond was worth a lot less. It was worth about 30% less.
Right.
So you know, bonds are a very tricky thing. They're much more volatile than stocks. A lot of people don't realize that, but they are.
Right. Okay. I think this is just a really good, encouraging take on the new year at a time when so many others out there are preaching a bit of doom and recession and reduced expectations. And I'm so glad to hear it from you, Ed Pitowski of Chapwood Investments. And I do appreciate your being here. Before we let you go, do you have any couple of specifics? Now, last time you came up with some exotic stuff, but if you could go a little more mainstream on, well, right now, if you had a little bit of money to put someplace, where you'd be putting it, given your rather bullish outlook for 2023.
Yeah, I would be putting it into large cap growth index. There's something called FNGU, which is a very, very risky way of investing in the FANGs. What it does is it breaks down the top 10 technology stocks, large cap, and breaks them into 10 different buckets. So there's 10 different stocks there, and it's leveraged 3-to-1. So if you're really into taking, you know, if you believe what I say about large cap growth, you want to buy FNGU.
all right, although it's a quite risky, risky move to do.
That's right, but I'm putting it out there, Dennis.
You should do it like you're betting at the roulette wheel, guys, and bet black 31. It's my favorite roulette wheel bet. I've hit on it 3 times out of maybe 10. And remember, whatever you invest in is on you guys and is your responsibility. Ed Butowski of Chapwood Investments out there in Plano, Texas. I'm so glad you joined us today. Thank you, and have a glorious new year, and I'll be talking to you soon.
You too. Thanks, Jess.
The Biden administration is constantly finding new ways to fail and then blaming others for it, except when it is intentionally failing on issues like the border and energy policy. Well, we're not going to let them get away with that. I'm Greg Corumbus. Join Jim Garrity of National Review and me each weekday for the Three Martini Lunch podcast. We'll give you the good, bad, and crazy news of the day and lots of laughs, too. Find us right here on the Ricochet Audio Network at ricochet.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now for today's parting shot. There's an awful lot of doom and anger in America these days, and it's manipulative and self-serving and bad for our health, as I've explained before. Long ago, when I was a reporter in my 20s at the Wall Street Journal, a mentor told me what sells there: light, not heat. By the time I was an anchor at CNBC, I wrote blog posts for the website, and the editor there told me that what sells is anger, outrage. Nowadays, a single mean tweet can generate 1,000 headlines. Republicans say Joe Biden is destroying America, instead of telling us that nobody can destroy America, and here's how they will keep building it. Democrats say white supremacists are the biggest domestic threat to America, which is a bunch of racist poppycock. Where are they? Market forecasters are one-upping each other over who can be more dire in their predictions of a great recession. None of this negativity leads to anything good. It can become self-defeating. We can talk ourselves off a cliff and into a recession. We can talk ourselves personally into a depression. A lot of young people today are way more depressed than they should be because we have spent 20 or 30 years telling them climate change will destroy the planet within their lifetime, which was both false and irresponsible. There is a better way, and you can make a New Year's resolution to try it out. Find the silver lining in every dark cloud. No matter what shall occur, find a way to be grateful for something good that can come out of it. I read this book a few years ago, The Power of Kabbalah, and it changed my life. It says we are born into 99.9% light, yet we spend our days focusing on the 0.1% that is darkness. And that darkness is the challenges of our everyday lives, the worries and struggles and conflicts and setbacks, the fights, the losses, and worse. We keep our heads down, staring into that abyss, instead of realizing that life is glorious and wonderful. If only we will look up to the horizon and into the light. If only we will choose to appreciate it. The Power of Kabbalah says that if I'm stuck on a stranded subway in the dark under the East River, running late for work, I should look up and force a smile rather than give in to anger and literally curse the darkness. Now, that's a nice idea. That little smile, the book says, that alone will let in light and help crowd out the darkness. If we just take pleasure in even small things, we have to learn to see them and acknowledge them. So after reading this, I was on a subway from Brooklyn, stuck beneath the East River and late for work, and I tried this. Literally, I forced a smile to my face. And it worked. It felt better to smile than to curse and complain. And we can make this choice 100 times a day. That wraps episode 5. Please like us in the Apple iTunes Store and on Google and Spotify. And subscribe to the Ricochet Network on YouTube. We are going to be huge. Have a glorious weekend, guys.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.